This is What's It Like with Dr. Ken Tangen.
Hi, this is Ken Tangen. This is episode 43 of What's It Like. My guest is Tony Camina, who is somewhere in Ohio, but you don't live there, do you?
Yeah. I live in Rocky River, Ohio, which is a western suburb of Cleveland, Ohio.
Did you grow up in that area?
Yes, I grew up here. I was born in 1958. I'm 53 years old. I grew up in this area, and I left, however, when I was 21 years old to work in the casino industry in Las Vegas.
Ah.
In early 1979, Nevada was the only jurisdiction that where you could actually make a living working in a casino, and then Atlantic City opened soon after that, and about 10 years later, just about every state started open.
Some reason I had you connected with Vegas in my head.
Yeah. I lived there for 25 years. Yeah, I didn't really move back here until 2004.
Did you come from a large family?
I am the youngest of three. My sister is 60, so she was born in 19... Actually, she's 62 or 3. She was born in 1948. My brother was born in 1950. Yeah, he just turned 60 about a year and a half ago. So I was like the one of the youngest baby boomers, I guess you would say. I think the baby boom ended in like 62, so I was at the tail end of that generation.
So what was the biggest influence on you growing up?
There was a critical moment in my life that kind of carved out what my career would be. We lived on a golf course, and the 8th green and 9th tee were literally in my backyard. And my father invested a very strong work ethic in us, and I just couldn't wait until I was old enough to make money. And the way to do that was to turn 11 or 12 years old and become a caddy. And I used to watch those caddies. My brother was a caddy, and they made all kinds of money. The only problem was when I turned 12, which at that time, unless you were a big 11-year-old, you had to be 12 to caddy.
Yeah.
When I turned 12, I weighed about 82 pounds soaking wet. And the first and only person I ever caddied for was a former Cleveland Brown football player. He's actually a Hall of Famer. Dante Lavelli was an old wide receiver for the Cleveland Browns. And I got through 8 holes. The bag weighed more than I did. I saw my house. I could see my mother through the kitchen window. And I just left him his bag and said, "You don't owe me anything," and walked home. But at that point, I said, you know, this is a lifelong dream of trying to make some money. I got to figure out what to do. And it didn't take me too long to realize that all the caddies with their money had to walk past my house. So I opened up a casino in my basement. Yeah, we started playing blackjack, and actually somebody had brought back from Las Vegas a little plastic roulette wheel that I ended up booking bets on until I found out that number 17 would come up about every fifth time because the wheel wasn't really calibrated.
So you were running a cricket house?
No. Actually, a few of my players figured out that 17 was always coming up. So I had to destroy that plastic wheel. And that lasted about 2 weeks. One of the mothers called my mother and said, "You know, do you know your son's operating a casino?" But at that point, I had a pretty good bankroll. I had a couple $100s, which was a lot of money back in 1970, and I pretty much knew that my career would take me to the gaming industry. And I worked, you know, very few what people would call legitimate jobs until I turned 21.
So, what was school like for you?
School was grade school was fun. High school, you know, once again, it was a business opportunity. I went to St. Edward's High School in Lakewood, Ohio. It was 2,000 boys. It was an all-boys Catholic high school. And, you know, at least 600 or 700 of them liked to bet on sports. So I turned out, you know, I started bookmaking there a little bit. And I actually didn't finish high school. I left. I was asked to leave, or I quit right before I was asked to leave. Someone tipped me off that I was going to get kicked out for lack of attendance the second month of my junior year in high school.
That never made sense to me as a policy.
Yeah.
You're not here enough. Go away.
And you know what? What's interesting is, you know, I've told my daughters many times during their schooling career, you know, they would always throw it back into me that, well, you know, what difference does it make? I mean, look at you. You know, you've done okay without an education. And I explained to them how lucky I was. And I really was that, you know, I managed to pick something that, you know, at the time when I was running a casino in my basement at 12 years old, gaming was looked upon as, you know, The only state where it was legal was Nevada, and everywhere else organized crime was running it. It was looked upon as a crime. But what ended up happening is I got into this industry in 1979 at the age of 21 years old, and by 1989, when everybody was going into lotteries and Indian casinos and riverboat gaming, and you know, my skills, which you couldn't really get at any university, my skills were in great demand. You know, so I've told my daughters, well, if you plan on figuring out the next growth industry and getting into that, then maybe you don't have to go to school. But, you know, the bottom line is, unless you're going to get lucky like me and just luckily pick that industry, which, you know, I didn't know it was going to be a growth industry, you know, chances are you better get some type of education. Mm-hmm. And they all did, thank God.
How did you get from the gaming industry to doing marketing for Ray Charles stuff?
Well, that was interesting. You know, I was always a Ray Charles fan. As a matter of fact, the first time I saw Ray perform, my father took me. It was Mother's Day 1966. So I was only 8 years old. There was a lady in our neighborhood whose husband had passed away, and he had all kinds of jazz albums, and she would give them to me for doing chores. Instead of money, she would give me old record albums. Most of them were instrumentals, but one of them was Ray's first album when he was like 20 years old. And I just loved that sound, and you know, continually went and got more and more Ray records that I had to buy at the record store. So I always liked Ray Charles.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh, throughout my whole life I would see Ray. I mean, even when I was 15, 16, and everyone wanted to go to the Led Zeppelin concert or the, you know, the Pink Floyd concert. And I went to those too, but, you know, I would get in my car and always go see Ray Charles. You know, many times I was the youngest person in the audience. And then when I moved to Las Vegas in 1979 when I was 21, you know, Ray would perform in the showrooms. He'd do 4 or 5 nights at Caesar's Palace. I'd go 3 out of the 4 nights. Never got to meet him. You know, back then, Ray was just, you know, basically, especially when he played Vegas, he would fly back to L.A. every night.
Yeah.
There was no need to, you know, no need to be in Las Vegas in a dark room when he could go back to his home and his studio, which right. He had memorized. He could see in those buildings.
And he was a busy guy.
And he was very busy, right. So years later, I was doing some consulting work for one of my gaming clients. It was a merchandise promotional company out of Chicago. And this gentleman, in addition to his merchandise promotional company, he also booked talent for some of these big corporate events.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that I was a huge Ray Charles fan, and he also knew that I never got to meet Ray. Even though pretty much every other Vegas entertainer I got to meet at some point, because back in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, they came into the bars just like we did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they worked in the hotel, whether it was right. Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin, they were working in the hotel. So when they got off work, they went to some bar, you know, down the street that wasn't connected to a hotel, and they hung out with us. So I got to meet, you know, a lot of big Las Vegas entertainers, but never got to meet Ray. And this gentleman knew this, and he booked Ray to do a concert in Oak Brook, Illinois, in January of 1999.
Illinois in January. Oh, boy.
Yeah, right. That was the funny thing is when he asked me, he said, Tony, he said, I need you to do me a favor. I've got this important person coming in January, and I need you to meet him and his assistant at the airport and then take him to the limousine, and the limousine's going to drive you and him and his assistant to the hotel. And I kind of need you to watch out for this guy for a couple days, and I can't really pay nothing, but I can give you a trip for free. And, you know, pick up your airfare in your hotel. And I'm like, Jimmy, I'm sitting in Las Vegas, and you're asking to fly me to Chicago on January 10th to literally be a bellman for somebody. You know, and he said, well, let me tell you who it is. It's Ray Charles. I just couldn't get on the plane fast enough. You know, before the show and then after the show, I got to talk with Ray. I was, I guess, overly overwhelmed. I mean, you know, my expectations, he far exceeded my expectations. The person that I thought he was all of these years was exactly that.
Hmm.
You know, and I think I think a lot of his longevity and a lot of Ray's career success was because of his honesty, that what you saw was mm-hmm. what you got. So in any event, I met Ray and we hit it off great. And, you know, I was only supposed to hang out with him in Chicago for those, my gosh, he was on the ground less than 24 hours. He landed at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday afternoon and left at 6 a.m. Wednesday morning. But a couple weeks later, Ray was playing Las Vegas, and he knew I lived in Las Vegas. And he had his valet, gentleman Vernon Troop, he'd passed away since then, he had him call me. He wanted me to bring my wife and my daughters to the show. And it was also a private engagement. It was for Hertz Rental Corporation. Yeah, their corporate annual meeting or something. Anyway, so I brought my wife and girls to the show, and, you know, Ray got to meet them. And I just found this very curious that, you know, the biggest superstar I ever met, you know, now he wants to meet my wife and kids. But shortly after my wife and daughters left the dressing room, he asked me to come work for him. And I explained to him.
It was a job interview.
Yeah, right. He just wanted to clear it. You know, he wanted to charm my wife that way. She wouldn't stand in the way. He was a very smart guy. He knew what he wanted. And he knew how to get it. You know, I said, Mr. Charles, I can't tell you how honored I am that you would ask, but, you know, I have a company. I have a partner. I have investors. And you know, at the time I was doing promotions for state lottery. I branched out from casinos into lotteries. And I said, I can't just, you know, tell these people, well, guess what? You know, one of my childhood heroes just offered me a job. I'm going to go travel the world with Ray Charles. He wanted me to be like a tour manager, an advance man. He said, well, what do you do for a living then? What is this business? And I told him about these promotions. What I was doing was I was getting the rights to, you know, very popular brand names and making them available to lotteries on scratch-off tickets. So, you know, instead of a Lucky Sevens ticket, you could do a Star Trek mm-hmm. ticket, or you could do a Harley Davidson ticket, or a Wheel of Fortune ticket, or Betty Boop. And Ray said, well, can you do a Ray Charles ticket? If you won't work for me, how about if I work for you? And this was his way of just keeping me, you know, Ray didn't need any money. Ray just wanted to be around people that made him laugh. I mean, you know, humor was a big thing to Ray. He was one of the happiest people I ever met. And, you know, he liked people that were, you know, pretty high functioning, people that took care of business, but at the same time that, you know, had some type of humor. And I guess I had that for him. So in any event, I said, yeah, I said, you know, I don't know about a Ray Charles ticket, but if you would do commercials like you did for Diet Pepsi, I'm certain I could sell that to lotteries. He said, okay, well, does Georgia have a lottery? I said, yeah. He said, well, go down there and tell them I'm available. We'll figure out the money. And if you can't sell Ray Charles to the Georgia Lottery, I really don't want to do business with you.
That's true.
And sure enough, I went to visit, it was a friend of mine, Rebecca Paul, ran the Georgia Lottery and at the time. And, you know, it took her 10 minutes to, you know, get that joke. And she hired Ray and we had a great time. Yeah, that was the beginning of a 5-year relationship with Ray that, you know, really ended. I mean, I had the honor of being a pallbearer at his funeral. So, I mean, I was with Ray as long as I possibly could have been. I actually placed him in his grave. Wonderful man and a big influence on my life, not only, you know, in a business end, but also in a personal end. He's a really good man.
So what do you actually do?
Well, I do the marketing of the intellectual property that Ray left us with. In layman's terms, that would be if you wanted to put Ray's face on a T-shirt, you would have to get those rights through me at my company. If you wanted to use one of Ray's songs in a motion picture or a television show or in a commercial advertisement, you would have to go through my company.
Now, the songs, TV and films, that's pretty standard stuff. But to put your image on something, how long can that last? How long do I own my image, for example?
Well, you know what's interesting, Ken, is it depends where you died. The rights to publicity are different from state to state. Now, Ray died in California, and he was a resident of California.
Right.
So it's perpetual. You know, the copyright on his name and image never runs out.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that is. That is. A fictional character, like Mickey Mouse, I think is 100 years. I'm not sure about that, but I think a fictional character, it's a copyright.
Uh-huh.
It's a copyright, which does have an expiration date. But with Ray, you're dealing with the publicity rights to a person.
Wow, and that lasts forever.
It lasts forever in America if you're in California. I think in New York, it dies with you.
Wow.
So, you know, but there's arguments going all over. I mean, one of the most famous arguments is about Marilyn Monroe, and technically she might have died in California, but she may have been a resident of New York, and, you know, so, but, yeah, the name and image, it goes on for a while. It'll be around long after I'm gone.
Yeah. The other one is Albert Einstein, isn't it? That's often used.
Albert Einstein's very big. Now, his name and image, I think, is owned by a trust that he set up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's actually represented by some good friends of mine at Greenlight Rights. but Albert Einstein's a good one.
Will his last forever too?
Yes, but then again, there's some countries that don't recognize that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, some countries, you know, we did a deal with, I think it was a bank in somewhere in Africa, and they used Gandhi, Albert Einstein, Ray Charles, Martin Luther King, and Rosa Parks, Nigeria, it was Nigeria, and two other Nigerian famous people in a commercial. And the only ones they paid for were Rosa Parks, Martin Luther King, and Ray Charles, because their law reads that if you've been dead for 40 years, it's over then. Yeah, but that was just, you know, it just depends on the country.
That's a pretty complex business.
Yes, it is. No, it is. I'm learning, you know, like I said, my background, I'm not a lawyer, but I've done more contracts than most lawyers have done in the last 2 or 3 years. I have taught law to some lawyers, but yes, it is very complicated. There's all kinds of nuances that come up with stuff like this. And what is a news story and what is a merchandise opportunity? What is art? I'll give you an example, Ken. If you had a beautiful photograph of Ray that you took at a concert, you know, you captured a wonderful moment mm-hmm. of Ray on stage.
Right.
You could probably sell a limited edition of those photographs that you signed as photographic art without paying me anything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I say probably because it just depends, you know, how many you're going to do.
Right.
You know, what is limited? Is a million limited? You know, but you could never put it on a t-shirt and sell it without paying me.
Hmm.
But, you know, so there's all kinds of different parts of that lot. It's very confusing.
What if Ray is walking down the street and I had taken his picture? Does that make a difference if he's in a public place?
No, it really doesn't. I mean, it depends. The only thing that would make the distinction there is, are you selling it as a piece of art or are you selling it as
commercial?
Right, as commercial work. Yeah. Are you putting it on a commercial product too? That's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, if it was for a news story, you don't have to pay me anything.
Right.
You know, if you were doing a news story about, you know, Ray Charles has been dead for 10 years or 7 years, whatever, and you wanted to do a news story, you could just use that. But you will have to pay the photographer.
Yes, because it's joint copy. Yes.
It's their copyright, right. Yeah, whoever took the photo, it's their copyright. So it's very interesting.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I mean,
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me thank you for your generosity. This has been such a fun project, and at every step along the way, people have been helpful and really big-hearted. They've rated our show on iTunes, they've told their friends about it, and they've donated money. If you would like to donate to the cause, click on the donate button at whatsitlike.info. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Oh, thank you.
And thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
What's the best thing about your job?
Well, the best thing about my job is that unlike a lot of people in my business, you know, the people that represent Jimi Hendrix, the people that represent Marilyn Monroe, James Dean, actually Jimi Hendrix is a bad example because he is represented by people that knew him and are related to him, as is John Wayne, is licensed by his children.
Mm.
But a lot of the people that, you know, represent other famous people never met them.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, they don't have the wonderful stories like I just told you a couple of them, of stories that I have with Ray. They don't have those stories to tell.
Right.
And they also, you know, they also don't have a connection to the person. They'll do things that, you know, part of the reason that the people who run Ray's Foundation agreed to allow me to represent Ray is in this regard is because I knew him.
Mm-hmm.
And they know that I'm going to be, and I loved him. I mean, we were very close friends, even though I only knew him for 5 years. You know, I spent a lot of time with him during those 5 years. And, you know, they knew that I wasn't going to do anything that would, you know, bring disrepute to his reputation.
Right.
Or, you know, make him look like a cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's important, but, you know, from a business end, you know, it does cost you money sometimes. But this isn't about that. I mean, Ray left, you know, all of the property that I'm talking about, whether it's his music or his name or his image, it all belongs to the Ray Charles Foundation. And the money goes to giving deaf children ear operations, and underprivileged children educational opportunities. And it's a wonderful foundation. But the fact of the matter is they don't need money, you know, so they can afford to turn down an offer or two because, you know, it's not that kind of party, as Ray would say. You know, this is, and he left them with a pretty substantial endowment. So the money that comes in is great, and it goes to give underprivileged children educational opportunities and hearing impaired children and adults, you know, operations and whatnot. But it's not critical that they make money. It isn't like, you know, the people who own the Elvis Presley image with Elvis's daughter. That's a big company. They need to make a certain amount of money every month just to break even.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't be turning down deals.
Yeah. What's the worst thing about your job?
The worst thing about my job is the travel. I mean, you know, I'm getting older, so I'm still traveling a bit. And also, I'll tell you, here's the frustrating thing, Ken. So much of our income, the income of the Ray Charles Marketing Group, is dependent upon a creative person getting an idea that uses our property. For instance, there's a man and a woman in a scene in a movie, and the man's leaving and he's going off to war, and this director of this film says, boy, you know what would work here perfectly is the Ray Charles version of Crying Time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, it's crying time again. You're going to leave me. I can see that faraway look in your eye. That would be perfect. Okay. Well, that's great, because the minute that director makes that decision, I just made some money for my company. We just gave another deaf child an ear operation. You know, it's a good thing, because money's coming, because those songs are not cheap for motion pictures. The problem is, I can't create for that creative person.
Mm-hmm.
Every time you give a creative person an idea, their nature as artists is to not do it then. No, it's really difficult. I mean, I've had some great, this is really true in the advertising business. I've had some incredible, I mean, it's just ideas that they don't even need explaining, you know, like patriotism sells pickup trucks. There's nothing, you know, every successful pickup truck commercial has some level of patriotism, with the exception of maybe Like a Rock, which really focused on how tough the truck was built, Bob Seger's Like a Rock. But,
yeah,
you know, you got the John Cougar Mellencamp, you know, this is our country, and see the USA in a Chevrolet. And I mean, you know, pick up, you know, it's red, white, and blue. So to use Ray Charles' version of America the Beautiful to sell pickup trucks, it's a no-brainer. And I've been approached. I will say this. A couple ad agencies have thought of it, but they just can't come up with the money because we're going to charge a lot for that. But, you know, just trying to get them to see things that way, it's tough. Maybe one of them will be listening to your interview, and that'll put a little, you know, thought and a little seed in their brain. But, yeah, that's tough. But, no, all in all, it's a wonderful way to make a living. I mean, I fly around the country and sometimes even outside the country and talk to people about, you know, my friend who happened to be a, you know, wonderful guy, accomplished a lot. And you know, at the end of the day, I mean, it is great to know that a lot of the work that I do is actually going towards, you know, a pretty good cause. I mean, this is what Ray wanted done with his money. And that is good. That's better, you know, a bunch of money to the bottom line, you know, of some faceless shareholders that you don't know. It's just different. Yeah. I've been on both sides of it. I mean, and there's, you know, obviously I'm very pro-business, and, you know, I think, you know, corporations are great. I worked with fantastic Steve Wynn's organization in the early 1980s at the Golden Nugget. I could tell you that was an honor just to work for that great man. But it is a little more special when you say, wow, you know, I just did this, and this money is going to go give some, you know, deaf child in El Segundo, an ear operation, and the kid's going to hear his mother's voice. That's pretty cool.
Well, what type of person would be good at your job?
Well, I think in my job, you need to like to travel, that's for sure, because the money doesn't come to you. You need to be in a hurry and yet have patience. And that's, you know, I know it's a contradiction, but what I'm saying is, you need to constantly instill urgency in the people you're trying to do business with, but at the same time, have patience that some of this has to just gestate and take time and come to you. And that's a skill that I had a real hard time developing, and I'm still working on it. I mean, you know, Ray used to tell me, you have the patience of a bank robber. mean, you have no patience whatsoever. And he was one to talk because he had very little patience, too. He was always in a hurry, a perpetual motion machine. You know, sometimes you just need to realize that, you know, this is all going to come in due time. I mean, my good friend and the wonderful lady that runs the Ray Charles Foundation, Valerie Irvin, she tells me that all the time. You know, you have to slow down. You have to slow down. Don't worry. It'll come to you.
Is there such a thing as a typical day in your life?
No, there isn't. But I will say this. I'm finding, now this is, you know, I've actually, Ray's been gone now 7 years. So I've been doing this for like 6 years. And I'm finding that it's very cyclical. I'm finding that we're getting most of the requests that we get for movies come in like July, August, September, and then actually happen around January, February, March. But they start to figure out what they want to use.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, songs for reality television shows or, you know, like Dancing with the Stars and whatnot, you know, those come in January and then they actually happen in May, April, May, June. So I'm starting to figure out when our busy time and when our slow time is. But the beautiful part about working with the Ray Charles brand is that no day is the same. I mean, you will get a request. He was so popular internationally that you will get a request. I have actually received requests to do Ray Charles door knockers in France. Yes, it's true. You know, the guy had a beautiful, it wasn't Ray's face. It was a pair of sunglasses or it was a piano, but he wanted to use Ray's name on it. You know, so you'll get the oddest requests and you'll say to yourself, how do these people even know about this song? Some of his fans in Japan, I mean, they know like every song Ray ever recorded. It's just incredible. So yeah, there is no typical day.
Tony will tell you what you should do with your life right after I remind you of the good work being done by the American Red Cross. It's not surprising that you know about the American Red Cross. It's been doing good for a long time. When my parents were prisoners of war, one of the things that saved their lives was a package they got from the Red Cross. Somewhere in the world today, there are people you can help through the Red Cross. So do them and yourself a favor. Go to the American Red Cross. Go to redcross.org. Thanks. So, Tony, everybody has to give themselves motivation occasionally. How do you give yourself a kick in the pants?
Well, now that the kids are grown, I really start to think about my legacy. When the kids were young and I was looking at tuition times three, of course, I'm still looking at weddings times three because I have three daughters, but, you know, that's enough motivation for anybody. You know, when the bills are rolling around, and you know, I was adamant that my wife would never work, so my wife never really helped out with the bills, but she certainly did work harder than I did raising those three kids. But, you know, because of that, I had enough motivation to make sure that, you know, I didn't let a lot of grass grow under my feet. You know, now that I've had some level of success, and, you know, it can be real tempting to take a breather. You know, plus, when I am working in an office, I'm working out of my home. So it's very tempting to go upstairs and eat some macaroni and cheese and take a nap. I really have to think now about my legacy. I really have to think now about, you know, the customers that have allowed me to live this way and what do I owe them? Because, you know, my main, in all of my businesses, whether it was the casino business or licensing Ray Charles or even some of the other consulting work that I've done, you know, my main motivation I learned from Theodore Levitt in one of the greatest books ever written in business. It's called The Marketing Imagination. I highly recommend it to your listeners. And, you know, the mantra in that book is the purpose of a business is to create a customer and keep a customer.
Hmm.
So in the creation of these customers and clients that I've had, you know, going all the way back to the early 1990s, I say to myself now, okay, what can I do to keep this customer? And what could I do to maintain the relationship? Because these are the people that educated my kids. You know, without their business, I do not get the money to pay Arizona State and Bowling Green University their tuition. You know, that comes with some level of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I have a responsibility to those customers to make sure that they're continually being, their expectations are being satisfied. And that kind of keeps me going. That keeps me motivated. Plus, I truly believe that if you're, nowadays in business, the way it's changing so much,
mm-hmm.
that really the motivation is there for you. I mean, you're never going to know your business because, you know, it as much as I knew, you know, marketing and what to do with Ray Charles, you know, some other new media comes along, you know, like Facebook or Twitter, and there's a whole new thing to learn about.
Let me turn the question around. When you need to soothe yourself, how do you calm yourself down?
Oh, boy, relaxing isn't one of my strong suits. I don't have a lot of hobbies. You know, my wife is an excellent cook, and I will, I mean, I have learned, let me say this, I've learned a few tricks on how to make, on how to dial the volume down. I never had a volume switch before. It used to be, it was a power switch. It was either on or off. And when it was on, it was cranked up to 10. I have learned now how to dial the volume down. And one of them is to not check your email, to turn your cell phone off and put it in a drawer at 6 o'clock, 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
Have your nice meal. I highly recommend red wine. I highly recommend a little bit of alcohol every day for those of your listeners that are that can do that without developing a dependency on alcohol. You know, it is a great medicine. And to watch something that is not, to watch what I call mindless television. You know, I've got friends that watch CNN and Fox News and MSNBC all day, and they walk around angry. I mean, there's nothing you're going to hear on those news programs that's going to make you happy. there really isn't anything on the news that's going to make you happy, because that isn't their business. They know that the real good stories are not that, you know, some boy got rescued. It's that, you know, somebody did something bad. So, you know, I like watching the mindless television and, you know, a good comedy every now and then.
Is there an event in your life that has challenged you to the core?
Yeah, there were times. Yeah. Yeah, there was in 2002, my marriage hit a really tough time, really tough time. And, you know, to the point where, you know, my wife literally moved me out of the house. I went on a business trip and came back, and she had rented me a home, put my clothes in that home, set my office up in the home with high-speed internet and cable television and all the premium channels and the football network, and said, this is where you live now, which, you know, it shows you, it's a real testament to my wife, how courteous she could be when she's kicking you out. She couldn't have made it any easier. You know, I know guys that have come home and their clothes are on the front lawn.
I believe they call that a gloved iron fist.
Yeah, exactly, Ken, very well put. That was tough. That was a very tough time. And, you know, Ray Charles himself actually gave me some advice during that time, because those were the times where I was traveling with him and the band quite a bit, introducing Ray to clients along throughout the country. And then, you know, sometimes late at night, I would just hang out in his hotel room and talk with him till 3-4 in the morning. And, you know, I'll never forget, he said to me one time, how pathetic is it that I'm giving you marriage advice? Because, you know, Ray really liked the women quite a bit, and they liked him back. He said, but really, he said, you know, I don't know your wife. I don't take sides and stuff like this, but, you know, you've got those three little girls. They're only going to be little for a little while longer. You really, you know, you really need to figure out a way to fix this. And and we did.
Is there an idea or a principle that has helped you through these challenges?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know if it's an idea or principle, but the one thing we all need to keep in mind when we're going through times like that is, if it's anything that people can correct, it's not a big deal.
Hmm.
Okay, if it's an argument with your wife, if it's something to do with work, if it's something where two or three people could sit at a table and correct it, or somebody could stop doing something, or somebody could start doing something, that's great. That's solvable. You've got a problem that is very solvable. But I'll tell you what, you get a tumor on your lung, or you get, you know, a tumor in your brain, there is no amount of people you could sit around a table and walk away with this thing solved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you really need to remember. There were times where I would, just wander around Las Vegas, driving around when I was having some trouble with my marriage. And I'll never forget, whenever I would hit a red light at St. Rose de Lima Hospital, I would always look in that hospital and say, my God, I think just about everybody in there would trade places with me, except maybe a few doctors. And it really does keep things in perspective. If you have a problem that people can solve, or a lottery ticket can solve, you know, by hitting the lottery because it's a financial problem, you really don't have a problem.
Yeah. If you were giving a commencement address for high school or college, what would you say? What would be your best advice?
I would tell them to buy three books, The Marketing Imagination by Theodore Levitt, regardless of whether they're in marketing or not. If they're going to be going into any type of business or any type of profession, even being a doctor, it's a great book to read. I would tell them to read Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. I think that's a wonderful book.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they did have a desire to go into business, I would ask them to read The 1,000 Things You Never Learned in Business School. I would also lecture the students to be as honest as they could. And what I mean by that is, I understand that you can't always be totally honest. You know, it's a wonderful thing to say, but you can't always be totally honest because you're going to hurt a lot of people's feelings in life.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to business, when it comes to matters of a material nature, where things are going to happen based on that, you have to be completely honest. And if you make a mistake, live up to it swiftly and certainly and address it. People will respect you for it. Admit it that you made a mistake. Don't ever try to cover it up. I mean, we've seen it so many times where people have gotten in more trouble for the cover-up than they did for the actual infraction.
Mm-hmm.
I would also tell them something that I heard from a very successful person, a little gentleman up there, up north there named George Lucas. He said this in a documentary, and it actually never made it to the final cut of the documentary. I saw it in a rough cut. So that's the reason I'm going to plagiarize it here, because it actually hasn't seen the light of day. And I really think it needs to be heard. I really do. It didn't. He might have said it in some other interview, but I know it wasn't in the documentary that I saw, even though it was supposed to be. But George Lucas said, you want to know what to do with your life? Someday you'll be doing something. You'll go down into your office, or you'll go somewhere, and you'll start something about 9 in the morning, and you'll be doing it. Maybe it's a hobby. Maybe it's coin collecting. Maybe it's stamp collecting. And then you say to yourself, you know what? I'm getting a little bit hungry here. And you look at your watch, and it's 6 o'clock at night. That's what you need to figure out to do the rest of your life. You need to do that for the rest of your life. Just figure out how to make someone pay you for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is, I've had that feeling, Ken, and I can tell you, it's incredible. I have thrown myself into work projects that were so gratifying that not only did I forget to eat, I didn't care to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just eating was just a necessary thing just to give me more energy so I could keep working on this thing. And I do believe that there is something that everyone has that they can contribute to society that where they could probably make a living at it that they like that much. A lot of people, I think, quit before they don't go for the brass ring. They don't, you know, they quit before they actually can achieve that. I mean, so many of my buddies told me in 1970s, you can't go to Las Vegas. You're from Avon, Ohio. It's, you know, it's a town of 9,000 people. You know, Vegas is going to eat you alive. You can't make it out there. And I'm like, guys, I'm going. I'm not coming back. There's nothing here in Cleveland. And, you know, yeah, I was broke within 3 weeks of getting to Las Vegas. And I was laid off. The casino that I was working in, they actually closed the poker room. I didn't even have a place to go work. You know, that was about 2 or 3 months after I got there. Mm. But, you know, I figured it out. You know, got another job, and I stuck it out. A lot of my sticking it out had to do with I wasn't going to come back and face those guys. Another thing that people find a lot in business, a lot of what I've experienced, and one of the things that I will advise your listeners is how to determine a failure. And what I mean by that is, I'll just give you a real life example. In 1990, I patented a process which would allow you to play Texas Hold'em poker on a scratch-off lottery ticket in 1990. I tried to sell that patent to every U.S. lottery for a period of 13 years and couldn't get anyone to bite on it. Now, understandably, at the time, Texas Hold'em poker was only recognizable in Nevada and Texas. I mean, in certain parts of California. You know, for the most part, you know, no one had heard of Texas Hold'em poker until, you know, the poker craze on television in 2002, 2003. So here I am paying the maintenance fees on this patent, continually, you know, showing it to lotteries around the country, and everyone's looking at me like I have two heads. And someone said to me once, when are you going to give up on this? And I said, when the customer has the opportunity to play it on a ticket and they choose to not play it.
Mm.
See, I didn't make this ticket for you guys. I made it for your customers. They determine whether it's a failure or not, not you guys. You just determine whether they get to play the game or not. And, well, let me say this. I mean, you know, in 2003, the Ohio Lottery was the first one to order it, and 17 lotteries ordered it in the next 6 weeks. So
some things take
the
time.
Players loved it. So, you know, but that's the thing is, you know, sometimes you'll be working on something And you tend to say, well, this thing's a failure. Well, why is it a failure? Well, because I couldn't get it to the next level. Well, that doesn't mean it's a failure. That just means that the next level, the people on the next level haven't seen this, you know, the value of it yet.
Right. My last question is to help me get better at this process. So think of a defining moment in your life we haven't talked about or something you wanted to say and haven't yet. What question should I have asked you to get you to tell me that story?
You should have asked me, if you could live your life over again, what's the one thing you wouldn't have changed?
Oh.
You know, people always ask you what you would have changed. But by definition, that will get you, Ken, the most defining moment in their life, is when they tell you what's the one thing you wouldn't have changed.
So, Tony, what's the one thing, if you were living your life over, that you wouldn't change?
Who I married.
Ah.
Yeah.
That's nice.
It's true. I mean, that's I was lucky enough to find the perfect wife for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing I wouldn't have changed. You know, if I had to protect one decision that I made, that would have been the decision. I think I would have been happy no matter what I would have done, but I don't think I'd be as happy as I am if I would have made, you know, the what I always consider the worst mistake a man can make, which is marrying the wrong woman.
I want to thank Tony Camina for joining me today. Thanks, Tony. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ken. I'm going to go to my family reunion. You have a great Carmageddon weekend.
Thank you so much.